Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 13th of January 2023 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Friday the 13th, unlucky for some, unlucky for the Templars. That's actually where the story comes from, that they have bad luck on Friday the 13th. The Templars, who were bankers and accused of sodomy and satanism, they were all rounded up and taken to court and prosecuted, and their leader Jacques de Molay was burnt at the stake. And that's where this Friday the 13th is unlucky comes from. So it might be that Friday the 13th is lucky in actual fact for people that don't support bankers, Satanists, and sodomists, sodomizers. That was another thing that they were accused of. But we're not here today to talk about Friday the 13th or the Templars. We are here today to talk a little bit about Charles Martel and Odo the Great. And of course, I do have with me today my two co-hosts, Truefids and Patriarch. Truefids, how are you doing, sir? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sven. Great to be back and to be speaking about great men like Charles Martel and Odo the Great, right?
Oh, we had good feedback as well from your summary of the battle last week as well. I think the show is doing really well with the three of us. We certainly seem to work well together, I think. Patriarch, how are you doing, sir? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Sven. It's good to be back as always and learn more about our great ancestors.
Certainly, they were quite incredible, some of the things that they did. And we should really be looking at this as inspirational. You know, we're made of the same blood as these people were. They're our extended family. That's what's so interesting about learning all this stuff about great history. Well, last week, as I say, we started talking a little bit about the Umayyads and the fact that they had taken over Spain. And then they ended up heading into Gaul. The Umayyad campaign into Aquitaine suffered a temporary setback at the Battle of Toulouse. Duke Odo the Great broke the siege of Toulouse, taking Al-Samid bin Malik's forces by surprise, and Al-Samid bin Malik was mortally wounded. This defeat did not stop incursions into old Roman Gaul, however, as Moorish forces, soundly based in Narbonne and easily resupplied by the sea, struck eastwards in the 720s, penetrating as far as Autun in Burgundy in 725. Threatened by both the Umayyads in the south and by the Franks in the north, in 730, Odo allied himself with the Berber commander, Uthman ibn Nasser, called Munuza by the Franks, the deputy governor of what would later become Catalonia. To seal the alliance, Uthman was given Odo's daughter Lampagi in marriage, and Moorish raids across the Pyrenees, Odo's southern border, ceased. However, the next year, the Berber leader killed the Bishop of Urgell, Nambaudus, and detached himself from his Arab masters in Cordova. Abdulrahman, in turn, sent an expedition to crush his revolt and next directed his attention against Uthman's ally, Odo. So I will just stop there. So we're hearing that there was this marriage alliance here, and it was with the Berbers. And the Berbers, they're white, I believe. They may be a little bit of a little bit non-white now, but I think back then in 730 they would have actually been white, these North African Berbers, and basically he had to make this alliance because of these Muslims that were trying to move into his part of the country. And at this time, I think he wasn't allied with Charles Martel. You had all these fallings out between these different Frankish great men at the time. Do you know anything about this, Truefids, or about Odo the Great, this period in history?
Yeah, so I believe the Berbers would have been from Kush, as far as I know, or at least they very likely were, right? And originally they were white, but because they were in that region, I believe Northern Africa a lot, and some of them would have moved over to Spain, because there was always Muslims from this time onwards. Eventually they all got mixed. It's possible that there's still some whites there, but you just don't know, right? And Odo the Great, he actually caught, it was an ambush that the Muslims had surrounded the city of Toulouse, And he caught them, as you said, completely by surprise. And that's probably why he had such a great victory, right? Because he was outnumbered. But this bought them 10 years. I actually looked it up and it was 10 years until the Battle of Tours. So Charles kind of heard of this and it gave him time to, you know, start building up his forces, because he obviously realized that there's a possibility of this great Arab conquest coming into goal, right?
So Odo helped him out really by sending off these Muslims, defeating them in this battle, and then I guess Charles Martel maybe softened in his view against Odo, because before this he was not allied with Odo at all. I mean, you pointed out last week that there were all these squabbles between these different princes and these different kings, and Charles Martel wasn't even a king. I mean, he was descended from the mayor, I think, as we'll find out when we get to him. But he was sort of leading as if he was king. He was king in all but name, basically. And he wanted Odo to pay fealty to him, and Odo refused. And it wasn't until after this battle that that they actually allied together. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I don't think someone would have given their daughter, given what we know about people sort of really conscious, racially conscious about their heritage and everything, they wouldn't have given their daughter to someone that would kind of distort their line, right? I'm sure it did happen, but I doubt it would have happened here.
Yeah, not at this time. I mean, it was very important that people could say their ancestry and their parentage. And if you think here, what you've actually got is royalty. You've got a princess, and we know how important it was that for these royal lines to say who their ancestors were. So it would have been very, very unlikely that that they were non-white. And of course, people might say, well, Truthviz there said that they originated in Kush and the Kushites, and were the Kushites, weren't the Kushites, were they black? No, the Kushites weren't black. Kush was Noah's grandson through Ham, Shem, and Japhet. They could all have only been one race because they were all brothers. Father was Noah, mother was Noah's wife. And Kush was one of the first civilizations. It's now called Ethiopia. And apparently Ethiop means shining face, which is obviously a sunburnt face, not a black face. And I think it's Herodotus writes about Kush, and he writes about the civilization there. And he says that they have the same customs, traditions, the same culture. They're just as civilized as the Greeks. And he goes into a long description of them. And then he also says, but there are some other tribes of people living in the land of Kush, and they are very, very far removed from the rest of humanity. They have long nails, they screech a lot, and they don't have any civilization at all. And he gives a physical description, and you can tell from the physical description that he's talking about these black tribes. So they were entirely separate to the white peoples that were in the land of Kush. And there's also, I think, reference to a famous Kushite king, and I can't quite recall the name of him. And I think he might have fought in the Trojan Wars. And of course, today you might get black Hebrew Israelites or black nationalists that might try and claim these people from the past, because obviously Ethiopia is now black. So they try to claim that the people that lived in Ethiopia 3,000, 4,000 years ago must also have been black. But of course they weren't. They were white. And white people have always migrated and moved from country to country, colonizing places. And as I say, these Kushites were supposedly one of the very, very first civilizations, the Kushites and the Egyptians. That's what it talks about in the book of Genesis. Anyway, Truthfords might know some more on this. Do you know which king it was? Is it King Menelaus or Agamemnon?
I just quickly Googled it. So I cheated. I couldn't remember, but it was Memnon. But yeah, he was from Ethiopia and he came over. It was to the close of the Trojan War, right? It was a big 10-year war, so it must have reached all the way to Ethiopia, and he came over, and then Achilles fought him, and Achilles defeated him, and from then he was known as the greatest warrior, because he even defeated the kings of Ethiopia. But I just want to say the Kushites had spread so far and wide. There's even the Kushite kingdoms in India, I believe, to this day, and they'd also spread all the way to North Africa, you know, right to the coast of the West. Arabia or used to be called Kush. You know, that's the original land of Kush. And then eventually that got renamed to Arabia, but they even spread, you know, very far. It shows you how far the white world was spreading even back then.
Yeah, Hindu Kush. There's the Hindu Kush mountains that are in India. They must have been named after the Kushites as well. So we can see from that that they had a huge civilization, and eventually those places got taken over. And the central place that was called Kush, which obviously now we have this Kush that was in Africa, Ethiopia. There was also this Kush that then became Arabia. As we know, the word Arab goes back to a Hebrew word for mixed race. And it actually goes back to the darkening as the sun goes down and the sky goes dark. It's related to that. And it's also related to two different types of wool, the warp and the weft. So it's sort of two things being blended together. There's all sorts of different connections to the word itself, Arab, but it essentially means of mixed race. And Arabia was named after the people that were there of mixed race. And it gets translated in the Bible as a mixed multitude, meaning a mixed race multitude. But of course, a lot of people look at that today and they'll say, oh, a mixed multitude, that just meant there were people from different nations there. No, it actually meant the multitude themselves were of mixed race. Well, moving back forwards in time to Odo again, he collected his army at Bordeaux, but was defeated and Bordeaux was plundered. During the following battle of the River Garonne, the Chronicle of 754 commented that God alone knows the number of the slain. The Chronicle of 754 continues, saying they pierced through the mountains, trampled over rough and level ground, plundered far into the country of the Franks, and smote all with the sword, insomuch that when Odo came to battle with them at the River Garonne, he fled. So after having this triumphant battle, which there may have been 350,000 of these Muslims that were actually slain. That was one of the reports. After that, they must have regrouped and they came back, and Odo ended up having to flee. Do you know anything about this battle, Trifiz? Is this one that you've looked at before?
Yeah. I mean, basically, the Arabs outnumbered him so massively that the only reason he won was the previous battle was because he ambushed them. When you're setting up a siege, you know, you'll have all your people not in formation in a circle around, you know, the fortified city. So if you're suddenly caught off guard with an army whilst here, he just didn't have that type of tactical advantage. And I did look it up. The Arabs, they were virtually all horsemen, high, you know, heavy cavalry and light cavalry mixed, and generally cavalry are seen as superior to infantry. So if you're outnumbered, 80,000 to 20,000, the statistics that you said last time, and their cavalry, well, you've got no chance, because if you fight on an open plain, you're just going to get surrounded and massacred, right? And if even part of your army starts to flee, well you can't flee because they're horsemen and they'll just catch up with you. So we see later that we're going to get to, the only way is some tactical genius like Charles Martel, who uses the landscape as we get to, you know, he lines them up in the forest. That's the only way that he could stand a chance, and we'll get to that, right?
Yeah, I suppose the cavalry were the equivalent of the tanks in their day, and a horse can move so much faster than a man can running. And this was also the largest army in the world at the time. The largest military force was this Muslim force. I mean, I just find it incredible that for within 100 years, I think it was, of Muhammad, this huge army had been amassed. And we look at it today as if it was a religion. But what happened at the start of Christianity? Well, you had these apostles that went out, you had these missionaries that went out, and, you know, they took a long time to convert people, and people were amazed at the fact that these people that claimed to be Christian, they would rather, you know, they would happily go to their deaths rather than recant their beliefs, and that's what converted people. And then you can contrast that with the growth of Islam. And a huge army is built up straight away, and they're off out into Europe conquering, and literally conquering great swathes of Asia and Spain. And you can see there that it's a religion of conquest. We're told today, oh, it's a religion of peace, because the word Islam itself is related to the word peace. But if you actually look at the history of it, you know, it's very, very different to Christianity. I think that's the mistake that people make. They look at Christianity and they say, well, all these other religions, they must be the same. And they're not. There's differences between them. They might all claim to be worshipping God, but that's about the only thing that links them together, I think. Patriarch, any thoughts on Odo here or anything else that we've been discussing?
Well, in terms of the battle, seeing that you say it's one of the largest forces amassed at that time, I mean, were they all coming over by ship? And if so, what would have kind of become of the trade routes at that time? Because they would have, such a massive force would have kind of threatened a lot of that, wouldn't it? I wonder if they kind of hijacked a lot of it. And
Well, I think what they were doing is they were coming over from North Africa. I mean, you have a route today, don't you, that goes into Spain, that the refugees or the migrants take, and they've just got that short hop, and then they're over into Spain. So that's what they would have been doing. They would have been coming over from Africa straight into Spain, and then when they were in Spain, they've already got the whole country of Spain. I think there was a part in the north that they didn't have, and then they'd then make their way up through Spain and into Gaul. So I think that was the route that they were coming from. And I guess through there, is that the same route that you've got to take to the Mediterranean? So it may well have been that there were problems getting through into the Mediterranean by sea at that point. You know, that's a good point that you raised. We'll have to have a look into that and see what was happening with the trade routes there. Because obviously, if the Muslims have got the whole of Spain, then, you know, the seas there as well would have been risky, and you could have been taken, captured as a slave. As we learned when we were doing our Christmas traditions one, that the Muslims were taking slaves back to Spain. Getting back to this battle here, or just after the battle, Odo, who despite the heavy losses was reorganizing his troops, gave the Frankish leader notice of the impending danger knocking on the heartland of his realm and appealed to the Franks for assistance, which Charles Martel only granted after Odo agreed to submit to Frankish authority. This was really the start of the bringing together of the tribes all under Charlemagne. You've got a similar thing that happened shortly after this with all the tribes in Britain coming under Alfred the Great. And at the start of this is the start of this with Odo submitting to Charles Martel, and then Charles Martel's grandson is Charlemagne, and then you got Charlemagne's empire. So we see here that they're finally starting to come together as a group, and that's, you know, that's the conditions that Charles Martel put on this. He said, I'm only going to fight alongside you if you agree to submit to my authority afterwards. Which he did. It appears that the Umayyads were not aware of the true strength of the Franks. The Umayyad forces were not particularly concerned about any of the Germanic tribes, including the Franks, and the Arab chronicles of that age show that awareness of the Franks as a growing military power only came after the Battle of Tours. Further, the Umayyads appear not to have scouted northwards for potential foes, for if they had, they surely would have noted Charles Martel as a force to be reckoned with in his own account because of his growing domination of much of Europe since 717. So they really overestimated their power as well, I think, these Muslims. Any thoughts on this, Treefitz?
Yeah, most of the success from the Arabs was due to the Germanic tribes constantly infighting, right, when they would come. I mean, if all of Franks had immediately, you know, banded together and formed a massive army, then it would have been different. But they could just gradually move in and take them one at a time, right? And the Germanic tribes wouldn't take it seriously. They're too busy on their own kingdom. Charles Martel, he was constantly fighting, you know, what we'd call Germany today, the Saxons and the other tribes, because they were still pagans. So they were still raiding the eastern border all the time. So Charles Martel had been, he'd formed this rock solid army. It was all heavy infantry. He had not a lot of cavalry, funny enough, because later on the Franks would mostly be known for their cavalry, right? Like in the battles with the English, where the English beat them with archers, longbowmen. But back then it was all heavy infantry. So he had to really form a plan on how to beat the Arabs, which we're going to get to, right?
Yeah, you could also see here as well the same things happen in Gaul that has happened in Britain. I mean, in Britain you had the Cymry, and then you had the Saxons that came in and took over, and the Cymry or the Britons, they also had Brittany, they also had parts of Gaul. You know, they had a Trojan origin as well. And then you've got the Germanic tribe that comes in, that becomes the Franks, and they become the overlords. And both the Cymry and the Scythians, both originally the same people, obviously the Britons and the Franks and the Saxons were all originally the same people. So it's just interesting the way that the fortunes change and how one part of our extended family rises to the top, and another part of our extended family then becomes the subjects. And it's continually changing throughout history. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I think it's the fact that Franks came in afterwards, obviously see that it's a common threat, you know. They just want to make sure that they might have underestimated the Muslims at first themselves, you know, thinking that the Gauls and that might be able to deal with it or take care of it, or it will be a problem that will kind of go away. But obviously they were quite persistent and expanding further, so they probably took it more seriously, realized they need to deal with it.
You've also got this, it's an early point in history as well. You've had the fall of Rome, basically the fall of Western Rome or Eastern Rome, and then you've got the whole of Spain, which is taken up by these Muslims. So they're really not going to know, are they, in Gaul, what's going on in North Africa, what's going on in Spain, because it's taken over by their enemies at this time. Well, we've got some contemporary reports of the battle. The Motes Arabic Chronicle of 754, quote, describes the battle in greater detail than any other Latin or Arabic source, close quote. And it calls itself the Motes Arabic Chronicle. So it might well be that it's an Arab chronicle. It says of the encounter, while Abd al-Rahman was pursuing Odo, he decided to despoil Tours by destroying its palaces and burning its churches. There he confronted the consul of Austrasia by the name of Charles, a man who, having proved himself to be a warrior from his youth and an expert in all things military, had been summoned by Odo. After each side had tormented the other with raids for almost 7 days, they finally prepared their battle lines and fought fiercely. The northern peoples remained as immobile as a wall, holding together like a glacier in the cold regions. In the blink of an eye, they annihilated the Arabs with the sword. The people of Austrasia, greater in a number of soldiers and formidably armed, killed the king, Abd al-Rahman, when they found him, striking him on the chest. But suddenly, within sight of the countless tents of the Arabs, the Franks despicably sheathed their swords, postponing the fight until the next day, since night had fallen during the battle. Rising from their own camp at dawn, the Europeans saw the tents and canopies of the Arabs all arranged just as they had appeared the day before. Not knowing that they were empty, and thinking that inside them there were Saracen forces ready for battle, they sent officers to reconnoitre and discovered that all the Ishmaelite troops had left. They had indeed fled silently by night in tight formation, returning to their own country. That says translation by Wolf, maybe Wolfalas, Chronicle of 754, page 145. And this is interesting because they say that, this was despicable that they sheathed their swords, but this was the European tradition. You didn't fight on at night. I think there was a British tradition that you fought on until tea time, and then you stopped for a cup of tea, very civilized, and your dinner. And then you met again the next day at the time that had already been appointed in order to carry on the battle. And you would obviously stop at a certain point so that medics could go forward and rescue the people that had fallen on the field that were still alive, take them back to medicate them and to remove the dead so that you could bury them. And then you would stop. And there was an agreement, you wouldn't continue on to fight at night. And then you would fight on again at daytime. I mean, it's basically the origin of things that we have today, like the Geneva Convention. You know, you had these agreements. And I think this tells us that this was an Arab that was writing this, because he says, you know, oh, it was despicable. They stopped fighting, you know, because night had fallen, because it was getting on into the evening. So they stopped fighting. But, you know, they expected the Arabs to do the same, because this was, you know, this was an Aryan tradition, I guess you could say, that probably went back centuries. Any thoughts, True Fitz?
Yeah, here you can see the propaganda that they called them Ishmaelite troops, that they weren't descended from Ishmaelites. That's a misconception, that they're just Arabs, that they would have lost their, you know, identity as this tribe or that tribe, you know, centuries before the Arab conquest, right? I just wanted to say that. But yeah, as for the sheath in the swords, that was because they were on infantry. They didn't want to risk, you know, chasing them and then getting surrounded, because they wouldn't be able to flee back. They just were playing it safe. And I completely understand that, right? As for the raid, right, I explained it last time, that a cavalry went round and started burning the Arab camp, and of course they had all their booty, so half the army suddenly fled to try and rescue all the treasures that they'd stolen. It was actually Odo the Great that led that cavalry. I just read that today. I didn't realize that. And on top of that, he was 80 years old at the time, leading a cavalry charge, you know, flanking round the back. So you know, he was at the end of his days, but he was still, you know, a formidable warrior, right?
Wow, that was Odo the Great, was it? He was 80.
Yeah, and Charles stayed with the troops. And, you know, obviously you'd want to have Charles there commanding them. And once half of the Arabs fled to protect their loot, he then ordered men to come out of the forest and surround them. He'd actually been keeping a lot of his army hidden in the forest to hide his true number. And then once half fled, he was able to surround them and slaughter them, because he was heavy infantry and the cavalry mostly relied on that charge, that impact to, you know, hit the infantry. But once you're locked in, the heavy infantry have the big advantage, right?
Quite incredible. And maybe we should also point out, for some of our listeners that maybe aren't so biblically literate, Ishmael was the brother of Isaac, and Ishmael's mother was Hagar, which was Abraham's servant woman. It says Hagar the Egyptian. Obviously, the Egyptians were white at that time, so Ishmael was white, but the promises were all given to the son through Sarah, which was Isaac. And Hagar was sent away with Ishmael, and obviously Ishmael, he did have something that was given to him, but because he was the firstborn, he was given some kind of a blessing. But he then went on to become a great slave trader and a great slave owner. And when you hear of Joseph being sold by his brothers, he was sold on to the Ishmaelites because they were great slave traders. And they became the first group to really sort of intermix with the slaves. And obviously because of that, they then lost their ancestry, because you can't say that you're descended from Ishmael if you're descended from Ishmael and then you're also descended from black Africans, or you're descended from Ishmael but then you're also descended from Chinamen, because you're no longer descended purely from Ishmael then and purely from his family. So I think that's what happened there. And then obviously they lost their ancestry and became the Arabs. And when the medieval chroniclers were referring to them, and they were trying to work out, well, who are these people? Where do they go back to? And they worked out that because they were the slave traders, that must be where they went back to. They went back to Ishmael. I mean, that's basically like a little potted history of it, because I know, you know, a lot of our listeners, you know, they're not, you know, haven't really become that interested in Christianity before. But of course, it bears a lot of relevance to our history. So that's why we include it. And also, obviously, Christian identity teachings, because the three of us here all believe the Christian identity teachings about history to be truthful and correct, because we've investigated them. Patriarch, any thoughts on this battle here, or Ishmael, or anything else that we've been discussing?
Just to elaborate on the reasons you mentioned, obviously, you know, being a mixed multitude, you can't really claim that Ishmaelite was the predominant lineage, but you can understand why it would have been used as a propaganda tool, and probably somewhere related to, like, to justify the firstborn of the people, and this is your right, you know, to inherit the blessings, as in most cultures, the firstborn was the one that received the, you know, the inheritance of the father. And so they probably thought that they had a claim to just, you know, it was just, you can see why it was used just as a political kind of rally tool. And especially with Christianity being rooted in bloodlines, I think this was a binding, a similar kind of binding allegiance to the term Ishmaelite.
Yeah, they certainly would have wanted to have that term to give themselves, what's the word, legitimacy, to give themselves legitimacy as rulers and what have you. But the fact of the matter was, Hagar was an Egyptian and Sarah was Hebrew. So that was the difference. I mean, it wasn't wrong of Abraham to have a child with the servant woman. I mean, that was within the law, because he thought that Sarah was too old to produce a child for him. She was in her 90s. But then she produced Isaac, and the promise was through that particular line, through Abraham's line, through Isaac, through Jacob, Israel, through this specific line. So, you know, anybody else that was outside of that line, then the promise wasn't to them. And if anybody that was from the line that had the promise and they married somebody that wasn't a part of that promise, then the offspring wasn't a part of that promise either. Getting back to these quotes that we have here, Charles Martel's family composed for the fourth book of the continuations of Fredegar's Chronicle a stylized summary of the battle. And they say Prince Charles boldly drew up his battle lines against them, the Arabs, and the warrior rushed in against them. With Christ's help, he overturned their tents and hastened to battle to grind them small in slaughter. The king, Abdirama, having been killed, he destroyed them, driving forth the army. He fought and won. Thus did the victor triumph over his enemies. That's from Four Acre, Continuations of Fredegar, page 149. And we can see there how important Christianity was to Charles Martel and his family. So that they credit this battle to Christ. It was through Christ's help that they defeated them. And I mean, we can see this right throughout these histories, because, you know, that was who King Arthur credited it to. And that was why, after King Arthur had defeated his enemies, they had a golden age, because they were then all obeying the Christian laws. And we can see that when the Saxons were fighting against the Cymry, once they became Christian, they would credit it to Christ, the fact that they had defeated the Cymry or the Britons. So I think, and this was obviously written at the time. This is Charles's Martel's family that wrote this. So it just tells you how important Christianity was at the time. And the source details further that he, Charles Martel, came down upon them like a great man of battle. And it goes on to say that Charles scattered them like the stubble. And the Latin word that was used for warrior there is belligerator, which comes from the Book of Maccabees, which describes huge battles. So that also tells us that the Book of Maccabees was included in the Bible at that time, or it was seen as canon. I mean, I guess it is still canon, but it's from the Apocrypha. It's not in the Bible without the Apocrypha. So that tells us that they were used to using the Apocrypha at the time. And it is thought that Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People includes a reference to the Battle of Tours, where it says, "A dreadful plague of Saracens ravaged France with miserable slaughter. But they, not long after in that country, received the punishment due to their wickedness." And again, you can see there that it's framed in the terms of good against evil. And that was the way that they saw this. And they were the army of Christ fighting against the infidels, the Saracens, the pagans, whatever you wanted to call them, and it was seen as just punishment for their wickedness. But I don't think the Arabs looked at it like that. They didn't look at it as you know, they were going after people that needed to be punished for their wickedness. They were just conquering the world for Allah, and that was all that was important to them. Trufids, any thoughts on Charles Martel's family's write-up here?
Yeah, I believe Martel means hammer. That it's like a nickname, Charles the Hammer. You know, just like Edward the First called himself Hammer of the Scots, probably after Charles Martel. And Maccabees actually means hammer, right? Because I forgot the exact. I think it was Judah that the hammer, because he was the first leader of. He was the son of a priest who rebelled against the Seleucid Empire, and he led them, and he was called the Hammer, and then they got that nickname, the Maccabees, but they were actually known as the Hasmonean dynasty, right? Because they came from originally from Parthia, the priesthood, which again shows you that that the Parthians must have been white as well, right? Because that's where these Maccabees came from, or Hasmoneans. But that's the relation with the name Hammer, Maccabees, Martel, and even Edward the First. You know, he wanted a bit of that glory. He wanted to be called the Hammer as well.
Well, he was, wasn't he? Called the Hammer of the Scots. So really, Charles Maccabeus is what they would have called him there. Again, I mean, it just shows you that they had access to the Apocrypha, and that was seen as just as legitimate as the rest of the Bible, I think. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I just find that the often the Apocrypha has a lot of deep insights that, you know, it's kind of done a disservice in these, especially the past few centuries, you know, of understanding this led to distortions in doctrine because things have been overlooked in our history.
Yeah, and we can't get mixed up between the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. I mean, the Apocrypha is these official books like the books of Maccabees, the books of Esdras, and then you get the Pseudepigrapha, which would be things like the books of Adam and Eve. And the books of Adam and Eve, they are useful. Books like that are useful because they explain to us what Christians were thinking at the time and how they interpreted things at the time. But it's not canon, it's not gospel, as it were. But when you look at the Apocrypha, like books like Maccabeus and Esdras, again, it continues the biblical story. If it contradicts the Bible, any parts of it contradict the Bible, then obviously you can't use the Apocrypha as that point. But most of it, I mean, from what I see, it fleshes it out. I mean, you've also got the Book of Enoch, haven't you, which is referred to in Jude. But then it's not included in the Bible. And then there are two or three, maybe even four books of Enoch. And I think the first
book
two...
Book of Jasher as well. Yeah, referenced.
Yeah, I would say the Book of Jasher is a fake one that was brought out by the rabbis. I did a podcast on that a while back. Yeah, just because of the terminology in it. And it also has them all intermarrying, Canaanites. It uses this term, as many as the sands of the sea, all the time, as if to say... Oh, that phrase was just a common phrase just to use as an exaggeration, because as we know, one of the promises that were made to Israel was that they would number as many as the sand of the sea. Mm. So this book Jasher includes that quite a lot to try and infer that was just an exaggeration. As I say, it also has the marrying Canaanites. And although the book of Jasher was referred to in the Old Testament, there's nothing to say that this book that the rabbis discovered, I think, in the 17th or 18th century, there's nothing to say that that book itself is the one that's being referred to in the Old Testament. If that book wasn't around at the time of Christ, you know, there's no copy of the Book of Jasher that's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It implies that the one that these rabbis discovered was fake. But again, what you're saying there, I mean, that highlights the fact that there are discrepancies and there are questions about where these apocryphal or pseudepigraphical books come from. I would say that that's a pseudepigrapha rather than apocrypha, because in the Bible that includes the Apocrypha, you wouldn't find a copy of Jasher in it. And I don't think you find a copy of Enoch in it either. Trufids, perhaps you might want to add some thoughts to this about the Apocrypha.
Yeah, I actually meant to mention this, but I forgot. Yeah. The Apocrypha was originally in the King James Bible, but then later it was removed. And then some of the Protestant They had their own Bibles, and then they removed it as well. But it should be in there, generally all the books. And then in the early 20th century, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that was when, you know, we started excavating the land of Israel whilst we still could, you know, the British Empire. And then a lot of these apocryphal books were found as well amongst, you know, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and all the old books. So they were definitely included. One of the Harvard professors, he was a white man, he said he saw a book of Enoch in there, and then Israel moved in and they took it all over. No one was allowed to have a look at it anymore. And then a few decades later, they opened it up again, and, you know, everything was allowed, everyone was allowed access again, but the book of Enoch had suddenly gone missing. And the guy, the Harvard professor, he spoke out against that, and he said some other things, and he was but he basically lost his job for that. But yeah, the book of Enoch should have been in there, but we don't have the original book of Enoch anymore.
Ah, right, because there's an Ethiopian version, isn't there? And there's another version, and they have slight differences. And obviously that's Apocrypha, but then you get Pseudepigrapha, which would be the book of Jasher, the book of Jubilees, the book of Adam and Eve. And the books of Adam and Eve are actually a particular favourite of mine, because it shows the way that the church interpreted things back in the second and the third century. And it talks about the most important thing for Adam's family and his sons was that they had nothing to do with the sons of Cain, and it even refers to it as no intercourse with the children of Cain. And obviously that meant no interaction, what have you. And it ends up with the sons of Adam going down and marrying the daughters of Cain, and that's the reason for the flood. And it makes it very clear that there are these two different bloodlines. There's a bloodline from Adam and there's a bloodline from Cain. And to think that was written in the second or the third century, you know, it's amazing, because it does bear out that that is the way that they interpreted the Bible back then. You know, they had this understanding of a seed line, basically, what today would be described as dual seed line, Christian identity. You know, they had that belief back then. So, and also the way that it's written, it's just fun to read, actually. There's four books to it, the books of Adam and Eve. Getting back to Charles Martel here. Charles Martel, in Latin, Carolus Martellus, Charles the Hammer. He was born 688 and he died October 22nd, 741. He was the Carolingian mayor of the palace from 715 to 41. He was a child born out of wedlock to Pippin of Herstal, who was the mayor of the palace, and he was the virtual ruler of the Frankish realm in the waning days of the Merovingian dynasty. And it was the Merovingian dynasty that started off with Childeric, I think, Childeric the First and Childeric the Second. And they converted to Christianity. So it was the subjects of the Merovingians that became the first Christians in Gaul, I think. And that line actually goes all the way forward to the starting of the Holy Roman Empire and the First Reich and the Second Reich. And it all goes back to Childeric the First. We did a little bit about this in an earlier episode. On Charles Martel's father's death, he overcame family opposition and rivals among the nobility to reunite and rule the entire Frankish realm. He subdued Neustria, which I guess would be Austria, attacked Aquitaine, and fought against the Frisians, they would have been where Holland is now, the Saxons, and the Bavarians. His victory at the Battle of Tours or Poitiers in 732 stemmed the Muslim invasion, and he controlled Burgundy by 739. He also supported the activities of Saint Boniface and other missionaries. In Frankish royal tradition, he divided the kingdom between his sons Pippin III and Carloman, who succeeded him as mayor, and his grandson was Charlemagne. So interesting there, we see that he fought against the Frisians, the Saxons and the Bavarians, and he conquered them. Not sure if they were Christians at this time, probably not. But you can see here that this is the startings of this Christian empire that actually became the Carolingian Empire that was that was started with Charlemagne, and that was something that Alfred the Great wanted to emulate. He saw Charlemagne as being a great hero because he started up this empire. So I think really you're starting to see the growth of Christianity here as well, within conquering the Frisians, the Saxons, and the Bavarians. So that's just like a little summary of Charles Martel there. Anything you want to add to that, Trufitz?
Yeah, I was going to say that it was Charlemagne who forcefully converted the Saxons to Christianity. As you can see, his grandfather's been constantly having battles with them. And then Charlemagne, who was also, he was having wars with Spain. He was, you know, going down there and invaded them as well. This time, the Franks were the aggressors. But at the same time, he was being raided constantly and he just had enough. And he just went over there and said, convert to Christianity or die. And he did kill a lot of Saxons who refused, or I believe they converted and then later they rebelled. But, you know, some pagans, they used that to say, see, Christianity was forced on us. You know, we never willingly converted. But it was only because Charlemagne was constantly raided. And then once the Germanic tribes there converted, they actually overtook the Franks and became the greatest nation in all of Europe. So it shows you that Christianity drastically improves a nation. It doesn't, you know, make it go backwards like the pagans claim, right?
Yeah, I'd like to do a program just looking at Charlemagne and looking into that, because that is something that the pagans like to bring up, this Charlemagne's persecution of this one group of Saxons. So we'll probably look at that in more detail later on. Patriarch, any thoughts on this summary of Charles Martel here?
Well, he helped to kind of create a strong well, as he amalgamated the nations, he probably came just in time for the previous battle, which we outlined, which was in 1754. So they were more likely to have rallied together in opposition. Otherwise, they'd have still been a bit more fractured, wouldn't they? And probably less of a force to fight off the Arabs or Ishmaelites.
Yeah, and also, I mean, it was so important that they did defeat them. I mean, if it hadn't have been that Charles Martel was there and he hooked up with Odo the Great and defeated them and was actually in that area at the time in the woods on the top of the hill, you know, the whole of Europe would have been taken by this army. I mean, don't forget, this is the hugest, the most vast, hugest, most well-equipped military force in the world at this time is the Muslim army. And it's just conquered great swathes from the death of Muhammad. It's just expanded, you know, with the sword, basically. Either convert to Islam or die or pay the jizya tax. And that was just the way that it was. And it massively expanded until it came up against Charles Martel. And the end result of that was that you had Odo that had pledged allegiance to him, and you had the various other peoples that pledged allegiance to him, and that was the start of the Carolingian Empire that was named after Charlemagne. And then you had Christianity taking over Gaul at that point, and it's showing you that Christianity is superior here, and it is something that helped these various different tribes to all become one. I mean, when you had paganism, they all had these different beliefs, but with Christianity, you had one belief, one universal belief that these different tribes that may have spoken slightly different languages, you know, they all came together under the same traditions and the same beliefs. And that's what Catholic meant. It meant universal. It meant that you would hear the same mass in Britain that you would hear in France, and it was read out in Latin, and it meant that they had the same Bibles that they were using. So that was very different to paganism, which had different beliefs depending on whichever tribe that it was. See, that also helped to unite the Europeans back then, because, I mean, what helps to unite us today is when you contrast white people against black people, and we all know, well, we're all white, and that provides a sense of unity. You didn't have that back then. Back then, you had Christians and pagans. And before we were even known as white people, we were known as the Christians, because that is what united all of us. As I say, it wasn't until America when we were contrasted against black people, that then we thought, right, well, actually, we're all united together by race. Before that, we were united together by religion. Moving back to Britain now and R.W. Morgan. Back in Britain, two battles had taken place, AD 7033, on the hills of Carnow, Glamorganshire, between Ethelbald and Hrodri. And I'm wondering if that's Hrodri the Great. In the latter of which, Hrodri was defeated. Perhaps not then. At Hereford, AD 742, Ethelbald was in turn routed, but in conjunction with Cuthred, again defeated Hrodri at Ostcliff, AD 743. 10 years afterwards, Cuthred was discomfited and slain by Hrodri at Gloucester. Hrodri died, AD 755, and was succeeded by Conan. Ethelbald fell the same year in civil strife against Burnred, who, being soon expelled, made way for Offa to the Mercian throne. Offa is a well-known king, obviously the person that set up Offa's Dyke that we will get into in a bit. The Golden Dragon, the standard of the military supremacy of Britain, held by West Saxony since the reign of Ivor, was now claimed and raised by Offa. The exact line of demarcation between the patrimony of the Cymry and the Saxonised regions east of it was attempted to be settled AD 780 by a treaty between Conan and Offa. The primitive line, which had in all ages marked off the Cymry from their sister tribe of Llogria, was that now called Wat's Dyke, and it became Offa's Dyke. The new boundary attempted to encroach 4 miles beyond it into Wales. The Cymry, therefore, declined to recognise it, and on the eve of St. Stephen's, the small forts erected at intervals upon it were stormed, the wardens put to the sword, and the rampart nearest Hereford levelled. Hereford then taken, Offa himself, after a gallant resistance, put to flight, with his palace plundered and fired. So we just stop there. So we can see that we're continuing to have these battles between the Cymry and the Saxons, and it is now acknowledged that the Saxons have the military supremacy of the island and the taxes being paid to London. And now you have this Saxon king Offa, and he makes this treaty with the Welsh that they'll have this line here between the two, but then he tries to encroach 4 miles beyond the line into Wales. And we still have Offa's Dyke that is there between Britain and Wales. Forming a league of the Anglo-Saxon kings, Offa led his forces into Vina Dulcia and was encountered at Hrudlan by Caradoc, the Prince of Powys, who commanded as Conan's lieutenant. The battle was attended with great slaughter on both sides. At nightfall, Caradoc fell, and the Cymry, giving way, abandoned the blood-stained field to the conqueror. Offa was carried home on a litter and died shortly afterwards from the wounds he had received in the engagement. And the dirge of Morva Rudland still commemorates among the Cymry the death of Caradoc on this fatal marsh, the canae of their Vina Dulcian annals. So that's looking at this from the Welsh view, of course. Any thoughts on this, Truefitz, Offa and Offa's Dyke?
Yeah, you can see that the Cymry or Welsh was still a formidable force, even, you know, about what, 750 or AD or just before. And so Hrodri and Conan, they were the Welsh kings, right? And Offa was battling them. But yeah, even Offa, it wasn't a pushover. You know, most people think that by about 500-600, oh, the Anglo-Saxons had it all, and that was the end of the Welsh. Well, no, they're still fighting toe to toe, and it's not all over just yet, right?
Yeah, and also, you know, the Welsh would fight against the Welsh as well. I mean, by this time, I think Saxons were seen as Britons, and they were seen as these individual tribes that, you know, had these basic spats with the Welsh. And he'd also had this intermarriage between the Welsh and the Saxons as well. So I think it was more seen as a battle between two different groups of Britons by this time, even though originally, you know, these Anglo-Saxons had actually come from Germany there. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
I'm just wondering what the reason for the war was. Is it just an extension of kind of you know, previous tensions or just trying to redefine boundaries? Was an expansion going off, or
it was, you know, a redefining of the boundary, wasn't it? They were trying to extend 4 miles in from the boundary and take right. an extra 4 miles worth of land. I mean, it doesn't sound that much, does it, when you think it's just 4 miles worth of land? But it was enough for them, because you got small kingdoms. You know, this was the kingdom of Powys, I think, not the whole of Wales, just this kingdom of Powys. And if you're going to lose 4 miles of land going all the way along that border, you know, that's a lot of land when you think about it. And obviously, this is why Offa wanted to do it. Well, we have a quote here from Stephen Goodson about King Offa. He says, King Offa ruled the kingdom of Mercia, which was bounded by the rivers Trent and Mersey in the north, the Thames Valley in the south, Wales in the west, and East Anglia and Essex in the east from 757 to 791 AD. So we can see there that there are all these various little kingdoms, and if he was to be encroaching 4 miles into the Welsh kingdom, that was a lot of land he was taking. It was one of the seven autonomous kingdoms of the Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy. Offa was a wise and able administrator and a kind-hearted leader. He established the first monetary system in England. On account of the scarcity of gold, he used silver for coinage and as a store of wealth. The standard unit of exchange was a pound of silver divided into 240 pennies, and the pennies were stamped with a star, the Old English for which is stiara, which is where we get the word sterling from. In 787, King Offa introduced a statute prohibiting usury, the charging of interest on money lent, a concept which goes back to the pagan era. And there's a very old quote that says that the Germanic tribes, that was something they refused to do. They refused to engage in usury. And this, of course, also goes back to the Old Testament. The Israelites, they refused to engage in usury amongst themselves, something which they had in common with these Germanic tribes. And obviously, this Saxon king here is introducing this statute, but in fact it was continuing a tradition which the pagans or the Saxons had anyway. The laws against usury were further entrenched by King Alfred, 865 to 899, who directed that the property of usurers be forfeited. I mean, it was seen as a very, very serious crime, this. And it wasn't, you know, today we'll look at usury and we'll say, oh, well, that means biting interest. That was a new definition that was introduced by the Pope, biting interest. They said that usury is just when you have extremely high interest. But in actual fact, usury means any interest at all that is put on a loan of money. And it was seen as a very, very serious crime. So you would lose all your property if you were caught doing this. While in 1050 AD, Edward the Confessor decreed not only that you would forfeit all your property, but that a usurer would be declared an outlaw and be banished for life. So we can see that that was a very, very serious crime. And there must have been a reason why they were doing this. So there must have been people in Offa's kingdom that were actually trying to engage in usury, or he wouldn't have needed to make this statute. And we should also not forget that at this time, we didn't actually have any Jews in Britain. We didn't have any Jews in Britain until 1066, when William the Conqueror came in and he brought the Jews with them. So this would have been Anglo-Saxons that were trying to engage in this. That would have been the reason why he needed to bring this law in, I would have thought. Any thoughts on King Offa and the money supply, usury, or any of the related issues, Truefitz?
Yeah, firstly, that Stephen Goodson, he's done a great book which goes through all the history of usury all throughout Europe and how it basically always ends up bringing down the countries and empires, right? And if you read Pliny, I believe, who gives a history of Rome, he tells you that there were people complaining about usury just a few centuries before Caesar came, right? And it was causing enormous problems because people would end up owning everything. And then Caesar, he tried to reverse some of it. You know, he tried to give more land to the poor and do those type of things. Some people theorize that's the real reason why he was assassinated. But anyways, Rome within 3 centuries was starting to weaken, and then it fell by, what, 450 years later, whilst we've had all these laws against usury, and we're still here, what, 1,200 years later? But you can see the real decline has happened in the past few centuries where we've allowed usury. So you can see it's really usury that destroys nations, right? So that's why they were so harsh and so against it. And with William the Conqueror, he needed, funding, because his army was heavily a mercenary army. He needed money. And obviously there were merchants willing to loan him, but only if they were allowed in. Once he, assuming that he won, that they would be allowed in. And then it was a few generations later, you remember King John, where we have Robin Hood, evil King John, he was letting the usurers run rampant. And that's why he was hated so much. And that's why the Lords forced Magna Carta on him, which heavily, banned a lot of this usury. That's kind of hidden. They always just say, oh, no, it's just because he was an evil king, but it was the usury that was causing a lot of the problems. And then his grandson, Edward I, he kicked them all out because he realized it was destroying the realm, right?
Yeah, usury, it's a weapon of war, isn't it? I think in the Old Testament, the Israelites, they're banned completely from engaging in usury amongst each other, but they can use it against the tribes that they're going to war against. You know, it's a weapon of war. That's why it shouldn't be used. And I mean, we mentioned it in the last episode that I think it was within 100 years of usury being, the Jews being in the country and being allowed to engage in usury, one of them had become the most wealthiest landowner in the country. As you pointed out, Truthford, you end up with people just owning huge amounts of wealth that they've only accumulated from usury, from interest on money. And if we look at the debt that we have today, we have trillions and trillions of pounds in debt. The whole world is. And yet when you look around at all the things that we've created, it's like, who is all this money owed to? We create all of this. We build all these things. We've built all these incredible things. Surely, it must be that we have masses and masses of wealth, but no, apparently we have masses and masses of debt. We're trillions of pounds in debt somehow to these banks. And also, this is why the old tradition was that you had a jubilee year. Every 50 years or every 40 years, all debts would be resolved and all the land would go back to the original family that owned it as well. And that kept things the way that they were. And that was without usury. People would still end up getting themselves into debt. So you had something called a jubilee, which zeroed everything. And I think Alfred the Great mentions this jubilee when he was writing up his laws. And I'm not sure whether it's absolutely 100% certain that he also instituted this jubilee or it was a part of the traditions. But he certainly mentioned it as being important. And obviously usury was banned back then. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I thought usury was, like you said before, about the Israelites couldn't, have usury for against each other. And I thought about this sometime before, and obviously it allows you to, I said, you know, it's okay to usury for people outside of your own kind. And I was trying to like rationalize, why that would be. And the only answer I kind of thought of was that, if lending money to non-kindred people, for example, without interest, then they would be partaking in the blessings of financial blessings of that people. So I think that's the only reason why I could see why just usury was ever justified, to just distinguish where the boundaries of that financial blessings were. And it was just like a wall almost, or just a defounding boundary.
Well, yeah, you've got that. You don't want the blessings, as in the funds of your group being siphoned off into another group, but also each one of these groups is competing against the other. So if you were to loan at usury to the other group, you could end up taking more land for your own group, couldn't you? If they were unable to pay it, you could end up taking parts of their land for your own group. You have to look at it as all these different groups are competing against one another. And the Israelites were given these laws to say, well, this is how to run things. This is how the political state needs to be. And this is how you need to treat these other groups. And if all of that had been followed, then the Israelites would have worked their way up to the top, basically, and they would have had a really good society. But they ended up going against all of these laws, breaking the laws, and ended up losing their nation. But then as Christians, if we were to follow the outline in the Old Testament, you know, these are the laws that you are supposed to have, then again, we would have a perfect society. So I think it goes down to we are competing against these other groups. The Israelites were certainly competing against the other groups around them. Either those groups would not come to try and borrow money from you, or your group would end up increasing its own wealth because of it. And we see that where we've allowed individuals from these other groups to come into our countries and engage in usury, they have been able to amass massive amounts of wealth. And that was the argument that was used by the Pope in order to legalize it. They said, look, you know, we've got this other group, this Jewish group in our country, who are allowed to obey their own laws. They are allowed to engage in usury, and they are amassing all these obscene amounts of wealth. And the way to deal with that is to allow Christians to engage in usury as well, so that the Christians can compete against the Jews. And that was the mistake that they made. What they should have said is the Jews should not be allowed to engage in usury in a Christian country, because in a Christian country, you're not allowed to engage in usury. And that's what they should have done. But instead, they said, right, well, we'll legalize usury, so we'll allow the Christians to compete against the Jews in the same way that the Jews are competing. So rather than behaving like Christians, our leaders behaved like Jews, and they legalized usury. So the end result of that is that the Jews end up increasing their wealth, increasing their power, and increasing their influence until we get to the situation today where we have like the Bank of England, and everything is now based on usury. You know, the answer to this was to say no usury for anyone. If Jews are going to live in our country, then they have to obey the Christian laws. That's what they should have said. Which is essentially what Edward I said. We're going to ban usury. And he tried to teach the Jews different trades. He spent 10 years, in fact, teaching the Jews different trades. And at the end of it, they were like, well, all we can do is lend money. That's really all that we're able to do. We're not able to pick up these trades. We don't learn them very well. And Edward I said, well, we are going to ban usury, and it's going to be the death sentence if you engage in usury. So you're going to have to leave the country if that's all you're able to do. So the Jews said, okay, we'll leave. And it was arranged that they would go to Holland. And it was also arranged that they could take all their wealth with them. They took, I think they paid a tax, 10% tax, something like that. And then they were allowed to take all their wealth with them, which they had earned from usury. So this is why I would say I don't think Edward I was an anti-Semite, because the Jews would have been able to stay if they had obeyed Christian law. And what Edward I wanted, he wanted the best for the Jews, which in his mind was that they would become Christians and they would stop engaging in usury. But they wouldn't stop engaging in usury. They said they weren't able to learn these other trades. So it was arranged for them to go to Holland. And they were expelled from the country. But the reason for it, they weren't expelled because they were Jews. They were expelled because they were going to be breaking the law. They wanted to break the law. That's why they were expelled. And rather than having them break the law and then executing them all, Edward I arranged for them to go to Holland, where the king there made use of the usury. And don't forget also, you know, this was a very good thing of Edward I to do, because these kings, when they owned the Jews, because it was seen that they were the king's Jews, the king would then make the money from the usury. The king would, when the Jews would end up with somebody that was in debt, the king would buy the debt from them and take over the land. So the Jews made a lot of money for these kings, basically. They would say, well, we were stuck in the middle. You know, the king would make all his wealth off of us, and we would be blamed by the people, and they would pogrom us. So that was the way that the Jews looked at it, and the kings looked at it, the monarchs looked at it, was, well, I'm able to earn a lot of money from these Jews, and when they die, I'm able to take all their wealth, so we'll allow them to continue doing this usury. And instead of that, Edward I said, no, we're going to ban usury. I don't care that as a monarch, I'm able to make money and earn lands from these Jews. This is a Christian country, we're going to ban usury. And that was what Edward I did. So the way I would look at it is different from the way that Jews would tell the story today, of course, because they would say he was an anti-Semite. But I don't think he was an anti-Semite. I think he wanted the best for the Jews, just like he wanted the best for all his subjects. And the best for them meant them going to Holland, because if they had stayed in Britain and carried on money lending at interest, they would have ended up being executed for that. And he didn't want to do that. And it was just a matter of that was the law. That was the Christian law. I think we'll have to leave that there. But of course, obviously, I'll offer this over to you, Truthvids, and poach you up for final comments there or on anything that I was just talking about there. So any thoughts on what I've just said, Truthvids?
Yeah, usually they'll say that King Edward was just evil. He hated them and he wanted to seize all their assets. So that's why that's why he did it. He was short on money. So it was a quick money grab. But you can see he gave them 10 years. And when they couldn't do it, he said, OK, look, sorry, you've got to go then. But yeah, you're completely right. A lot of the kings saw it as an opportunity by using them as tax collectors and money lenders to build up wealth. Because kings couldn't commit usury, but then they could use the Jews to do it. And you know, obviously this was really short-sighted, because the end result is eventually the kings get weaker and weaker, and eventually the Jews got so powerful they just overthrew all the kings, and now they run it. So obviously it was a very stupid move, you know, obviously with hindsight, but when you see the end result, right?
Yeah, I say with hindsight, they should have just obeyed the Christian law and banned it for everyone, like Edward I did. But, you know, that's not what the popes did. They said, well, we'll allow a certain amount of usury. We'll say over 10% is usury, under 10% is okay, and we'll allow Christians to engage in this. And they set up, I think, the Monte di Pietà, the Mount of Charity, and it was a Christian group, and it was seen as this was being charitable to the poor. We'll lend them money, and we'll only put a certain amount of interest on it, less than what the Jews put on it. And it was portrayed as helping the poor, but of course it didn't. It basically legalized something which never should have been legalized, which has ended up with this massive debt that we have today. Patriarch, any final thoughts on all of this today or on usury?
Yeah, well, the end result is clear, isn't it? Where you've got corporations or powerful entities which just ultimately supersede the nation. So, yeah, if only things could be changed now.
Yeah, it always with hindsight, isn't it? With hindsight, we really should have just stuck to our Christian laws. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Truthvids.
Thanks for having me, Sven.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, you. Thanks, Sven. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope that you have a great weekend ahead of you.